hearing. This is the House Insular and, pardon me, Interior and Insular Affairs Committee Subcommittee on Water Power and Offshore Energy Resources. This is the first congressional hearing in Alaska on the Exxon Valdez oil spill incident. The committee will be joining us in the ballroom in a few minutes, and we'll be getting underway. Today we will have four congressmen in attendance. The chairman of this subcommittee is Democratic Representative George Miller of California. He'll be here along with Representative Wayne Owen, a Democrat of Utah, and Representative Peter DeFazio, a Democrat of Oregon. A fourth member who is traveling with the subcommittee, Representative Bruce Vento of Minnesota, is not with the committee today. We understand that he is in an inspection trip flying along the beaches on the Katmai National Monument area along the western side of Cook Inlet to assess the damage over on that end of the oil spill impact area. He will be joining the committee here in Valdez tomorrow. Also with the committee today is Representative Richard Durbin, a Democrat of Illinois. Representative Durbin, though not a member of this subcommittee, is a member of the House Appropriations Committee Subcommittee on Transportation, and as such is responsible for the budget of the U.S. Coast Guard, which is part of the U.S. Department of Transportation. The members of the committee are now filing into the ballroom. There are a number of TV cameras. This is almost reminiscent of the early press conferences, although this is a much different setting. This is a formal congressional hearing. There'll be no questions from the public or press. The members of the congressional panel will be doing the questioning of a series of witnesses, starting off today with John Devens, the mayor of the city of Valdez, followed by a panel of two state officials, Commissioner Dennis Kelso of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. The chairman has banged the gavel. The committee hearing is about to begin. This is Representative George Miller of California.
House Interior Committee will come to order. The purpose of this hearing is to conduct oversight and investigations of the Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound, Alaska. The committee has spent the last couple of days in the Prince William Sound area touring the oil spill, visiting with residents of the sound, talking to them about the impact of the oil spill on their lives, their businesses, their communities, visiting the beaches, witnessing some of the cleanup efforts that are being made on behalf of all of the interested parties in cleaning up this spill. We've met and been briefed by various governmental agencies and private entities that are involved in this effort. This afternoon, we start, which will be the first of a number of hearings that will be held by this this committee to look into all of the ramifications of this incident and try and see not only what we can do to prevent it, but exactly what happened here in Valdez on the night of the night of the spill. Because of the nature of this hearing, being an investigative hearing, it will be the practice of the committee to swear all of the witnesses prior to their testimony. That will continue throughout this entire investigative hearing of the subcommittee. I might identify myself. I'm Congressman George Miller from California. From the 7th Congressional District, which is borders on San Francisco Bay. And with that, I would like to recognize my colleagues for any statements that that they might have. And first of all, to recognize Congressman Owens of Utah. Wayne?
Well, just briefly, Mr. Chairman, Peter DeFazio, 4th District, Oregon, represent half the Oregon coast, the southern half. I've just got to say, in our brief visit, I've heard more contradictory information and comments, anecdotal things presented to us anecdotally and factually, and I look forward to the hearing to perhaps helping us to sort out fact from fiction in this whole account. I have nothing further to say at this time.
I want to thank Chairman Miller for inviting me to participate in this hearing. Although I'm not a member of this subcommittee, I'm a member of the Appropriations Committee. And on the Transportation Subcommittee, we have jurisdiction over the United States Coast Guard. So I have an abiding interest in their role in this response. I might say, in following along the comments made by my colleague, Mr. DeFazio from Oregon, that this has been a very informative several days that we've spent here, and I'm sure these next 2 days will be as well. We have seen some extraordinary efforts being made by some extraordinary people to cope with an environmental disaster, which was certainly captured the attention of America and continues to. I come from the state of Illinois. We do not have a shoreline to worry about or to reap the benefits from, as many of my colleagues do. But this is a national concern. It is one that transcends location, and it transcends any of the individuals involved in it. What we hope to do is to get to the bottom of this particular incident, to establish what was done in response to prepare for it, what was done when it was discovered, and what lessons we can learn for future legislation. And I commend Chairman Miller for bringing us to Alaska to explore these very challenging issues.
Thank you. The first witness that the committee will hear from is the Honorable John Devins, who is the mayor of the city of Valdez, Alaska. Mayor Devins, if you please come forward. Let's see here. Welcome to the committee. Your formal testimony will be placed in the record in its entirety, and you will be allowed to proceed in the manner in which you're most comfortable. But as I said at the outset, because of the nature of this series of hearings, the investigative nature of this hearings, it will be the practice of this subcommittee to swear all witnesses who appear before it. Do you have any objections to being sworn?
None whatsoever, sir.
I would ask that you would rise and raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear to affirm that the testimony that you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. In order to inform you of your rights as a witness before the committee and the limitations on the authority of the subcommittee, the rules of the House of Representatives and the committee are on the table in front of you. Both sets of rules have been previously been provided to you. You are advised that your right to counsel, the role of counsel, would be to advise you of your constitutional rights. Do you desire to be represented by counsel?
No, I do not.
Thank you. Again, welcome, Mr. Mayor, to the committee, and we look forward to your testimony.
Well, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity, and I want to welcome you to Valdez. Speaking, I believe, for all of Prince William Sound, we're happy that a congressional hearing is going to be conducted here and that you have taken the time to investigate this. All too often, things that affect Alaska are done elsewhere, and it is gratifying to know that you're here looking at the situation. Too often, Alaskans feel as though we're treated as another nation rather than a state, and to have this this committee here looking at a situation that is certainly affecting the state of Alaska, and in particular Prince William Sound and the communities in the Sound, we do welcome you and we appreciate it. I have given you a written testimony. I will not bore you by reading a written testimony that you have before you, but I do have some comments that I would like to make. To go back to the early part of the spill, the first 2 or 3 days of the spill, we realized immediately that this was a very large spill, that the spill was going to cause a great amount of devastation to our communities within Prince William Sound. At that time, we had no idea that the spill would reach as far as it has, going down along the Kenai Peninsula and also going as far as Kodiak, and it hasn't stopped yet. But the first day of the spill, I contacted the mayor of Cordova, Erling Johansson, and suggested to him that I thought it was a good idea for the two communities that appeared to be most affected by this to contact the governor of the state of Alaska and request that he contact the President of the United States and request a declaration of disaster. Thus far, we have not received a declaration of disaster. We're still hopeful that something such as this might come out because we have devastation of our business communities and the local municipalities that are probably not going to be covered by the standard methods of repair. And we still feel that we need more aid from the federal government. You have many communities now that are affected. I started to mention them earlier, but Valdez is probably the most impacted in terms of people that have come here seeking jobs, and it puts a great amount of stress upon the local city government. However, you have communities such as Cordova, which are totally dependent upon fisheries, which are going to be economically devastated by this. We have communities such as Whittier, which is a small community, not a very wealthy community, that is having their city government affected greatly. You have Chenega and Tetitlik, which are subsistence communities. Their entire way of life is threatened by this. You have the communities on the peninsula, the Kenai Peninsula, that are being affected from their tourism and their fisheries industries. Kodiak, which is being greatly affected in terms of its fisheries industry. And in fact, we have communities all over the state of Alaska that are being affected by this spill from cancellations of tourists that were going to come to Alaska and are now fearful of what they're going to see or what this is going to do to them. We have communities that are as much as hundreds, even a thousand miles from the spill that have had up to a third of their tourism bookings canceled, primarily because of an oil spill. I have little faith, based on the track record that we've seen thus far, that the beach cleanup plan that was presented several days ago is actually going to work. I know several nights ago I was on a television program with an Exxon executive, and of course he has great faith in the plan. He was expressing his faith in the plan. I was expressing my skepticism about the plan. Those of you who have been on the beaches realize that the chance of cleaning those beaches by September is pretty minimal. We are fearful that after September, knowing the weather that we have in Prince William Sound, that the operations will be shut down. We expect them to be shut down for the winter, and rightly, they should be shut down during the winter months. It's too dangerous to have people on those beaches. But we're fearful that next spring, when it's time to resume the cleaning and the restoration of the sound, that Exxon may come back with some environmental scientists who say that Mother Nature's doing a better job and to do nothing. And we're very fearful of that, and we hope that the Congress of the United States will keep a close eye on this and will apply the pressures that are needed to keep Exxon working on this until we have a complete cleanup and a complete restoration of Prince William Sound. And when I say Prince William Sound, please allow me to also include the peninsula, Kodiak, and the other areas that are affected. It's just easier to refer to it as Prince William Sound. The restoration that I'm talking about goes beyond just the birds and mammals. We've seen, I think I read recently, 20 tons of birds and mammals that need to be destroyed, the carcasses. Maybe it was 20,000 pounds, but it's an awful lot of birds and mammals, and it's certainly going to affect the Prince William Sound for many years to come in terms of getting these populations restored. But when we talk restoration, we're also talking the commercial fishing industry, we're talking the visitor industry, our tourism, and we're talking the recreational aspects of Prince William Sound. The other area that we're concerned about, and I've mentioned before, and that is keeping both the communities and the businesses within the community solvent. Valdez has realized for many years that the oil industry is a finite industry. The day will come when we will run out of oil in Alaska. Hopefully that doesn't happen in the near future, because the country relies on 25% of its supply of crude oil coming from Alaska. But it will run out. And Valdez has spent much of its tax base over the past number of years to build divergent industries or diversified industries such as the tourism, the fisheries, and the transportation. One area that we would like to encourage you to look at as you go through these deliberations, I know that you are an investigative committee, and I'm not here today to point fingers to anyone. That's going to come out from your investigation, the other investigations. But I must implore that we develop a better plan for the future. I don't believe any thoughtful individual can look at what has happened here and believe that industry was truly ready for a disaster of this magnitude. It's not up to me to try to decide who was to blame on this, but we must have a better response for the next oil spill. We are promoting an emergency oil spill response team similar to the one in Norway. Norway has 13 separate sites along their coast to respond immediately to an oil spill. Horten, Norway is the center of this, the nucleus of this program, where 20 employees are ready to go to work immediately if there's an oil spill. They have 12 other sites with 10 employees in each. If there's an oil spill in Norway, they're ready to respond. They aren't going to wait days before they can get booming materials out, get skimmers out, and get to picking up that oil. We are hoping that something can be done so that not only the state of Alaska, but we need emergency oil spill response teams from Barrow, Alaska to Southern California, so that anytime there's a spill such as this, we don't have to rely on industry to get in there and clean it up. There are too many problems with waiting for decisions to be made. We need someone that can do it immediately. Valdez passed an ordinance on May 22, 1986, in which we set up an environmental service area. We applied an additional 4-mil tax to the oil industry that is located within our municipal boundaries. That tax was to be used to put into place the equipment and materials that were needed for an emergency oil spill. This could have been a nucleus for this type of oil spill response team. Unfortunately, we were challenged by the state of Alaska with regard to our authority to impose this additional tax, and we've been in the courts ever since. But had we had that, we would have been ready to have responded in a much more reliable fashion than we have seen. We must be ready in the future, and I pray that this committee will do what you can to help us develop better standards for future oil spills. I'm here and willing to answer any questions that you might have, and I again would like to repeat that we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to come to Prince William Sound to hold these hearings.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony, and let me say how impressed I think all of us have been with the citizens of Prince William Sound. We have visited with many of them out in the cleanup effort. I was here some 3 weeks ago and visited with many of the fishermen who were involved in the early effort and many of the defensive actions that were taking place. And I must tell you, they were certainly a very dedicated and hardworking group of individuals that obviously had a tremendous sense of community about the threat to Prince William Sound, and I think that same statement can be made for, as you said, the entire Sound, not just the residents of Valdez. And we were also, I think, very impressed with people who came here from other parts of Alaska to help out to make this effort the best that it could be. And it's a compliment to you and to your community. Let me just ask you, if I might, with respect to the tax that you sought to impose, the state challenged you on what basis and why?
A home rule municipality such as Valdez, under the state charter, is permitted for different services within their municipal boundaries. However, the Alaska statute that set up laws governing the Alaska pipeline said that oil property must be taxed at the same rate that other citizens within the community are taxed. Our debate was we were offering additional services in the way of fire, police. Within this special tax area, we would have provided preferential berthing for tankers to our city dock. We were going to provide oil spill cleanup. We wanted to train our emergency services force, which amounted to approximately 30 people, in oil spill response techniques. We had a plan for an emergency oil spill response team on environmental basis. The state of Alaska challenged us because of the special taxing nature in this state on oil property.
Mayor, you say that you're not here to point fingers, and unfortunately we're here to see where fingers should be pointed, and therefore would like you, if you would, to review for the committee exactly what you saw in terms of response. You've outlined a couple of failures in response during your written testimony. But what did you see the first day, day one, March 24th? Either that was responsive or not responsive on the part of Valjeska.
I certainly don't mind doing that. 6 a.m. on March 24th, I was awakened by a call from Dave Hammack, who is the manager of the public radio station. Dave informed me that it was time to put my mayoral hat on. I wear a couple of hats. Put my mayoral hat on because we've had a big oil spill. Well, we've had other oil spills, and in fact, in January, we had two oil spills that we called big. By comparison, they were little oil spills, but they were cleaned up. They were cleaned up very effectively, very quickly, and there was no environmental damage. I guess at 6 a.m. that morning, I thought probably we'd had another oil spill comparable to the two British Petroleum spills in January. But I did get up, and I knew that it was an Exxon spill, and I immediately started to call Exxon, the people that I had contact with in the past. I received, well, I couldn't reach anyone with Exxon, and I tried to call Alyeska. I tried to call George Nelson with Alyeska, and there was no answer until about 8:30 that morning. At the same time, I tried to reach someone that could fly me out and take me over the site, because now more information was flowing in, and we could see, no, this is not the kind of oil spill we've had in the past. This is a much greater oil spill. By 11:30 that morning, I had finally gotten Chuck LePage, who runs a local flying service, to fly me out. We flew over at 11:30. What we saw at 11:30 that morning was the Exxon Valdez apparently stuck on a rock near Bly Island. There was a very large puddle of oil circling it, probably several square miles in area. We saw, as I recall, and I was out there several times, but I think at that time we also saw the Baton Rouge getting into place, discharging their ballast water. Later that day, I got a photographer out, which would have been probably about 15 hours after the spill. The photographer took pictures of the spill. Again, things had not changed. The next day I got out, and there was, at that time, we saw two boats and a boom. We didn't see any skimmers at that time, but we saw two boats with a boom between them, and they seemed to be in the middle of the oil patch. And I'm not familiar enough with the technique of oil pickup to know what they were doing, but it didn't appear that there was much happening at that time. Actually, for the first 3 days when we would go out, yes. That would have been the 25th, yes. Now, I the last time on the 24th I was out was about noon on the 24th. And by noon on the 24th, there was virtually nothing happening. The next day, we did see some small boats out there. We saw some booming. Other people that were out reported seeing some skimmers. When I was there, I saw no skimmer. That was true. In my observation, for the first 3 days, we saw very little activity that really constituted trying to pick up oil. The fourth day is the day that the winds came up, and at that point, the oil was blowing out to the west, and after that, of course, it's the time that it got on the beaches, and the moose formed. And
did you have any conversations with Alyeska officials during that period of time, direct conversations?
Yes, the first day, as I was saying, I'll go back to my telephone calls. I left word. I finally got a hold of an answering machine at Exxon and left word that the city of Valdez was willing to cooperate in any way we could. We had money set aside for oil spill emergency. We planned to use that to purchase materials, but it was available. I asked them to call me back. I also indicated we had manpower, that if they needed manpower initially, the city of Valdez would make staff available to help in this. I never did get called back from Exxon, but I don't remember now if it was that day or the next day that Frank Iarossi arrived, and they had arranged then for me to have an interview with him, but it was late in the evening, he was tired, and he went back to his hotel. I didn't see him that day. Then the next day, the lieutenant governor arrived, and late that evening, and I think this was on the 25th, but I might be wrong, it could have been on the 26th. I have those notes, but I didn't bring them with me. But we met, the lieutenant governor set up a meeting, and we met with Mr. Iarossi in his hotel room over at the Westmark, and at that time we expressed some of our concerns about the oil cleanup, the speed of it, and also concerns about how the business community was going to be affected by this. With regards to Alyeska, that day I did get a hold of someone in Mr. Nelson's office who indicated that Mr. Nelson had already left by either plane or helicopter for the site and was coming to Valdez. Later that day, I did have an opportunity to talk to George Nelson along with some of his staff out at the airport. We were there waiting for Governor Cooper to arrive, and we spoke.
Any recommendations to them at any time?
You know, in all honesty, I know we talked about the spill. I know that Mr. Nelson was somewhat irritated with me because a committee that we had recommended more support for the Department of Environmental Conservation, and we talked about that. I would assume that I probably at that time was not making recommendations because it was still very early, and we really at that time didn't know the extent of the disaster, nor did we know the first day that things were not going to be done in a more expedient fashion.
As a last question, during the course since March 24th, have you made recommendations or requests to Alyeska or Exxon in your official capacity, which have either been followed or ignored?
Since that first day, Alyeska has been pretty much out of the picture in terms of authority. Alyeska did provide me with a helicopter ride out to look at the site, and it didn't seem appropriate to make recommendations to Alyeska at that time. I have made some recommendations to Exxon. Primarily, they've been things that I've already said, that I've expressed my disappointment about the amount of oil that's been picked up. I've expressed my disappointment with allowing it to get on the beaches, and certainly expressed our concern about the impact on the communities. We, as a city council, requested housing to be provided for the people that are coming into the community, the workers that are working for VECO out on the spill. VECO is contracted to Exxon. Those kinds of suggestions have been made.
Thank you.
The questioning by Representative Wayne Owen of Utah.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to just, pursue the disaster designation a little bit. You and the Mayor of Cordova made that request to the governor. The governor formally made the request to the president, and there's just been no communication back. What about the Alyeska congressional delegation, the two senators and the representative? Have they been able to tell you what's going on at the White House, why you haven't received a designation?
Well, after we made that that request, it was several days after. It was the day after Secretary Skinner, Admiral Yost, Senator Murkowski, and others arrived. They came in, I think maybe it was the third or fourth day, and I'm sure the record would show when they arrived. They came in. I went out to the airport to meet them. At that time, for whatever reason, they did not want to take any input locally. They went from their Coast Guard jet directly to a helicopter, directly to the site, came back. I guess they did have a press conference when they got back, but we weren't aware that was going to happen, so I wasn't there. The next day after that, they flew back into Valdez. I was invited up to our local Coast Guard headquarters and was asked to make a presentation with regard to this impact on Valdez. At that time, I had already had information from the media that the group that had gone out did not feel that the extent of this disaster was as great as they had expected. So I felt that I was a little alarmed and felt that I was somewhat behind the eight ball going in and making a presentation requesting a declaration of disaster, but I did make that declaration or that request for the declaration of disaster to that group. I was told at that time that FEMA would be activated if it was a declaration of disaster, and it would provide many services, many a great amount of help for the community. However, a declaration of disaster was not given on a man-made disaster, only on a natural disaster, and they didn't feel that this was going to be a natural disaster, so they didn't see that FEMA could come in. We then talked about the possibility of getting the Small Business Administration in to help. Later, I went back and spoke or testified before the Maritime and Fisheries Commission, or the congressional hearings for the National Maritime and Fisheries. And at that time, I again hit on the need for a declaration of disaster. So far, I don't feel we have gotten much support from anyone. I think the rationale behind it is that if a declaration of disaster is declared, in some way this removes Exxon from some of their liability. It's beyond my understanding, but that's the kind of answers that I get when I try to talk about this. A declaration of disaster would be a great thing for the state of Alaska right now, and it would help immensely the communities and the businesses that are involved in being hurt by this. But for some reason, we really have not found anyone that is willing to carry that ball for us.
Thank you.
Evans, I suppose that one of the more difficult aspects of our job is to try to piece together the whole mosaic here of what is happening in Prince William Sound. We're being handed small pieces of this puzzle by different agencies and different people, and without a picture of what this mosaic's to look like, we're not quite sure where the pieces fit in. But some of the facts that have come out in the few days that we've been here, and as Chairman Miller indicated, our own experience going out with the cleanup crews, I think would buttress your conclusion about the September 15th target date. As I understand it, as of May 5th of this year, less than 2 miles of coastline had been cleaned. Exxon's estimate is that some 364 miles of coastline has been affected in varying degrees, but we've heard estimates as high as 600 miles of coastline. Smith Island, for example, where we visited, and I think the Vice President also visited, had been cleaned twice before we visited it. And I have to tell you honestly, I think the crew will have to return there to take a look at it. There are still very serious problems here. So it appears that at least with the current resources that are being used for this job, that the goal of increasing the mileage of coastline cleaned to reach completion by September 15th appears unrealistic. Do you have any observations from the people that you've spoken to working in this capacity or from other sources to suggest what might be necessary to get this job done?
That question from Congressman Richard Durbin.
Well, now I'm put in a place of being an expert in an area that I'm obviously not an expert. It's quite obvious, I'm certainly an intelligent person, and I can divide quite well, and I realize that in terms of the length of time it's taken to clean 2 miles of beach, and really that's a misnomer to say it's clean, because the 2 miles that has been, or less than 2 miles that has been worked on, is not clean and probably will not be clean. There's no way that they can complete this by September. We hear lots of reports, and I'm sure you've heard the same reports, and it's probably just redundancy on my part to repeat this, but there are lots of reports of the workers that are out there, and they're working hard, but the organization, the ability to get the job done, doesn't seem to be in terms of the orders that are being given. People, we've heard the reports of one where they had contained a great amount of oil in a boom, and one of the bosses came along and said, we need this boom over here, and they said, well, there's oil here, let's clean this up. Well, forget about that. So they pulled that boom out and let that oil go again. Well, that's all rumor, but we hear it consistently enough and often enough from the people that are out there working when they do get back into town, that there has to be some degree of truth. And the proof of the pudding is in the eating. I mean, right now we see that after all of this work that's been done and the numbers of people that they have on the beaches, we still have less than 2 miles of beach that's been affected.
Points in your testimony about economic losses I'd like to explore as well. Our contacts with Exxon suggest from a meeting yesterday that they are committed to compensating economic losses as part of their response to this disaster. Now, it's very interesting to me, because I sit on both the Budget and Appropriations Committee, that most communities, and your own included, first turn to the federal government in the hopes that a disaster designation will be given to help your local businesses. At least most of the activity to date by Exxon has been under the supervision of government agencies and has been subject to compensation, so that Exxon has been paying into the 311K fund, as I understand it, to compensate for the expenses involved in this cleanup. What activities to date has Exxon initiated to compensate businesses in Valdez or other communities for the losses which they are experiencing?
Another question.
My information comes from the representatives of the Small Business Association that was here. They had visited with Exxon, and the businesses were broken down into three categories: primary, secondary, and tertiary. The primary were those individuals that were directly affected by the spill. Those are primarily the fishermen. Exxon indicated that they would stand full responsibility for the losses that were documented by these fishermen. You will have people testifying on fishing that will be much more knowledgeable than I am, but there are some holes in that. But that is by far the best that were promised. The secondary people that were affected were those who were not as directly affected, but who had some degree of claim. I think this might be tour boat operators. Now, I can't recall because I don't have that paper in front of me, but anyway, the secondary people, Exxon at the time the Small Business Association met with them, were indicating that there was some chance that they would work with the secondary individuals. The tertiary people are the people, the street side businesses, your restaurants, your hotels, people that are dependent upon tourism, hardware stores, what have you. Those people, plus the workers that are counting on the jobs in some of these areas like the processing plants, those I believe fall under the tertiary, and they are not covered, and they're not likely to be covered. The other factor that we're concerned about, and the last council meeting I did ask a representative from Exxon to comment on it, and he very honestly said that he really couldn't comment on it, but there is a $100 million limit on the cost of an oil spill based on Alaska statutes. Now, there are other ways of going about getting relief, but the primary one is the Alaska statute that limits the response to $100 million. One area of caution that I'm exercising right now is If Exxon exercises that and pulls out after they've spent $100 million, and if they haven't already, they must be getting very close to $100 million on this spill, we could have people put into a position where the only way they will be compensated for their loss is through litigation. And you cannot make your payments, you can't pay your debts based on paper that shows that you've got a lawsuit in against Exxon. We know from the Amoco Cadiz disaster that it took 11 years before there was any payment, and even then, I think it was something like $100 million against a $2 billion claim. So if we look at litigation to take care of this, we'll have a lot of people that will lose their businesses in the meantime, and a lot of people that will be unemployed.
Testimony that to date, Exxon has not established any non-judicial mechanism for a business which has suffered losses because of this disaster to recover their losses.
Well, I believe Exxon has actually placed money into an account that individuals can draw against. I don't believe that people that fall in that tertiary group have any ability to draw against that, and I think people in the secondary group probably are having difficulty. My guess is, and it's purely a guess because I don't have a business, I haven't applied to Exxon, but my guess is that the fishermen and the people that would fall into the primary group probably could draw on this, I think, $10 million account. One has to be concerned, though. What kinds of waivers do people have to sign? Another area that falls right along this, I just came from a mayor's conference. The mayors that are all involved in the oil spill. And the concern that the mayors all have are the number and the variety of contracts that are out there. Boat operators, people that are working for Exxon, either through VECO or directly. There are many different kinds of contracts. The city of Kodiak pulled it in and said, look, we don't want any contracts that haven't been reviewed by the city attorney. We want to have all of our boat operators, all of our fishermen receive the same kind of contract. Some of the rest of us have not done that, but history may prove that we should have.
Same conclusion, Mr. Mayor. What we've learned is as the oil spill has reached areas that no one ever envisioned, this disaster is reaching people and businesses and affecting lives that no one ever envisioned when it first occurred. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Next, the panel will hear from Mr. Dennis Kelso, who is the Commissioner, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and Mr. Frank Rue, who is the Director of Habitat Division, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. If you'll come forward, we welcome you to the committee and appreciate you taking your time to come and to testify. As I said at the outset, it is the practice of the subcommittee to swear all witnesses who appear before it in investigative hearings. Do you have any objections to being sworn?
Mr. Chairman,
if you would please rise and raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony that you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. In order to inform you of your rights as a witness before the committee and the limitations on the authority of the subcommittee, the rules of the House of Representatives and the committee are on the table in front of you. Both sets of rules have previously been provided to you. You are advised of your right to counsel. The role of counsel would be to advise you of your constitutional rights. Do you desire to be represented by counsel?
No, Mr. Chairman.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Again, welcome to the committee, and Dennis, we appreciate you taking time from what has been an unbelievable schedule for you over the last 45 days. But I think your testimony is important to this to this committee. Let me just say on a personal note how much I appreciate your involvement with this committee on a number of different issues that affect Alaska and your forthrightness in proceeding with us and taking your time when I was here 3 weeks ago when you were running a pretty heavy schedule there to show us some of the impacts of some of your concerns and the state's concerns about this spill. Please go ahead and proceed, and again, your written statement will be put into the entire record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm Dennis Kelso, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before this committee today. Governor Cooper has asked me to convey personally to you his thanks for your continued interest in the Exxon oil spill disaster. It is not possible for me to summarize in a brief statement the scope of the entire incident, and that includes public policy, past, present, and future. Therefore, I'll focus on several key points and attempt to expand on them as you and your colleagues see fit during questions. The points are, first, the industry's response during the first critical 72 hours of the spill was ineffective, in part because of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company's decade-long efforts to scuttle any meaningful oil spill contingency plan. Second, Alyeska failed to carry out their oil spill plan, and Exxon was unprepared and unable to implement an effective response. Third, the industry's response in the following weeks has sometimes been reluctant and myopic, characterized by stalling techniques, disinformation, and a refusal to pay real attention to damage outside of Prince William Sound. I was present in Prince William Sound nearly every day during the first 5 weeks of the spill. The enormity of the disaster continues to stagger my imagination, and I am, like most Alaskans, accustomed to viewing events and the landscape on a much larger scale than most Americans. According to the most recent overflights, oil from the Exxon Valdez has, in one form or another, already reached nearshore areas of the Alaska Peninsula. That's roughly 550 miles southwest of Valdez. The miles of fouled shoreline is even greater. If this had happened on America's Atlantic seaboard, oil, filthy foam, and tar balls would be washing up on the beaches from Boston, around Cape Cod, down Long Island Sound, along the sandy beaches of New Jersey, past Cape May, to the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, and perhaps up into the Potomac itself. The distances alone are staggering, and we haven't even considered the economic and environmental damage on a coastline of that length. Mr. Chairman, you can see why the state of Alaska and the people continue to keep intense pressure on reluctant corporations, Exxon and Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, to attack and clean up this mess in an effective manner. Concerning the first 72 hours of the spill, let me describe an example of the response to these events. The Exxon Corporation has, over the past few weeks, deliberately attempted to portray the company's response as hampered by state government. The most recent and most flagrant abuse of misinformation occurred in the May 8th issue of Fortune magazine, in which Exxon's chairman Lawrence Rawl repeated untrue statements about the company's supposed efforts to use chemical dispersants from March 24th through